This is truly an honor, a gift, a privilege. It's a miracle, and it's also beyond words that I'm actually standing up here looking out at all of you and introducing my dear friend Tony. Once upon a time, I lost everything. I was abandoned by everything except my vodka. And finally, without my vodka, I felt even my own soul abandon me. That is naked, raw suffering. But I tried to do what they told me for once, an empty shell still looking for my soul. And then I saw Tony, and my life and my soul began to stir. I probably spent a total of 10 minutes with her the whole time in treatment, and she did my aftercare plan, but I watched her a lot, and she would smile at me. And I've only seen her 2 times in the last 7 years, but my soul knows Tony's soul believes in love and life, and I know Tony believes in me and believed in me from the moment she saw me. And Tony, I want to thank you for breathing life into my shell.
God, that is powerful. My name is Tony Curry, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. Oh, what a treat to have Dorothea here introducing me and to be here with all you ladies. It is just a spiritual experience. And it really is something to remember that Dorothea and I did have very few minutes together back in those days, but our souls connected. And we've been emotionally close ever since. I saw her for the first time in 5 years, 2 years ago, and we continued our conversation as if it had never ended. And it's a wonderful experience to have a really true friend like that. I want to thank the committee and all of you ladies for inviting me to come up here. I just appreciate the opportunity. You have much more to give me than I have to give you. I have just been so uplifted by everything I've heard and shared. From getting here last night and hearing Cheryl, and Cheryl was in AA when I got here. She was one of the role models for me. She'd been sober just about a year when I came into the program and was a role model, and we share many common experiences together. And then the workshops today have just added to that connectedness that I feel with all of you. And there are so many soul connections that I have out there. It's just a joy to be here with you. I love sharing with women, and I think we have something special to share with each other. When I first came into the program, I had such unhealthy relationships with men. And my sponsors told me, if you're going to get sober, you're going to have to go to some women's meetings. And for a long, long time, my home group was that same women's group that Cheryl talked about last night and that somebody else mentioned earlier today. So you have meant a lot to me, and there's so many of you out there that I feel connected to and value the opportunity to be here with you. It's just a wonderful, wonderful experience. You know, everywhere I go, I see these connections. Last weekend, I was at Fellowship Hall in Greensboro, North Carolina, walking through the lobby, and there was Willie. And Willie made the first 12-step call on me in April of 1971. And I've seen Willie 2 times since 1971. And that came about because I was drunk with Willie's cousin in Atlanta. And Willie's cousin, when we started trying to stop drinking, we knew we had to stop sooner or later. And when we tried to stop drinking, we could not. And Willie's cousin got scared, and he had Willie in Virginia in AA, and he called Willie, and he failed to mention that he was drunk, but he said, there's this lady down here in Atlanta who's got this really terrific alcohol problem, and would you please come and talk to her? And Willie was on a plane the next day, and he didn't even know me, but at the request of his cousin came down to talk to me. And I can still see Willie standing in my kitchen saying, just try us for 90 days. And if you don't like it, we'll give you all your misery back. And I looked at that man and I thought, I wish to hell he'd leave so I can drink that beer that's in my refrigerator. And that's exactly what I did. When he left, I drank the beer. But Willie introduced me to AA. And that was such a powerful experience to see him last weekend and to feel that connection that I haven't felt but twice since then. I've only seen him twice. And the interesting thing to me was that he's had a relapse since then. He had 19 years, and then he went out and relapsed. And, you know, he shared that with me last weekend, and that's a message to me. That's a powerful message, that it doesn't matter how much time we have today. That's really what we have. And so I value the opportunity to share with him, to share with the group last week, to share with you this weekend, and I just appreciate the opportunity of being here. And I'm supposed to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And you know what it was like. Most of you out there experienced it too. And I believe we can all just about tell each other stories. Every time I hear somebody talk, I think, yeah, that's me. That's what I did. That's the way I felt. So we can just about tell each other stories. I was from that hotbed of alcoholism, the Baptist Church. And you were too, huh? And I was also from the other hotbed of alcoholism, a family where addiction ran rampant. And I am from a family where everybody who has ever used became addicted. Fortunately, I am from a family of recovery. And everybody who became addicted eventually recovered before death. And the last known addicted person is currently in treatment for cocaine and marijuana addiction, and that's my brother. And I'm so grateful to be able to say that, because I've been praying for him for a long, long time. And he's the last known addict in our family. But considering that my children's legacy is rampant addiction on both sides of the family, and everybody on the other side of the family died of addiction, everybody who used, their legacy is not too good, and since I have those three children, I suspect it's not the last time I'll hear about it in my lifetime. But I do hope that if that comes about, that because of my recovery and because of my foundation in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they will perhaps have an opportunity to get to recovery earlier. That's my fervent prayer. I didn't intend to drink because I didn't ever want to be like my daddy. I didn't ever want to be an alcoholic. I was determined not to turn out that way. And I managed not to drink. I managed to be a teetotaler until after I married. And after I married, I began drinking just like most of us begin drinking. It was so innocent. It was to be a part of the group. All the young couples that ran around together, we had so much fun. And they all drank, and they didn't have problems with it. And we didn't keep it in our home because his father was an alcoholic and my father was an alcoholic, and we had a healthy fear of it. But we did drink on the weekends, social occasions, and when we would go out to dinner, and it was all so innocent. And I drank less than anybody. And I'll bet you if you were to ask all the young couples that we ran around with in those days who would have turned out to be an alcoholic, my name would have been the last one on the list. But all of them are doing fine. As far as I know, I'm the only one. But I didn't intend to be that way. And I managed to drink what you would call socially for 10 years. Only when I look back on it, it's what Dr. John Mooney called control drinking. And I believe I've experienced controlled drinking and uncontrolled drinking. And I've never experienced being able to drink socially. I was so fearful of it, I just really controlled it rigidly. Would not have over two. And when I did have over two, I could feel it. I could feel it. I didn't like the way it made me feel. I didn't like the feeling of getting out of control. But a couple of times during that 10-year period, I drank too much by accident on vacation times, and I went into blackouts. And I know that I had alcoholism even then, even though it didn't look like it. It was there even then, because I believe blackouts are peculiar to those of us who have this disease. And I do believe I have this disease, and I stand here before you a miracle. Last week when the chairman introduced me as a speaker at Fellowship Hall, she said, "I heard Tony's tape," and she said, "I know what all she did, and it just seems to me she ought to look a little more damaged than she looked." And, you know, knowing what I've lived through, it seems to me I ought to feel a little more damaged than I feel. But I don't feel damaged. I feel blessed. I feel like it's been an asset to me. And I don't mean that I want to repeat it. I don't want to go back there and repeat all that again. But I wouldn't take anything for having experienced it. You know, I feel like God has really, whatever God is, has let me really live. God has let me really experience life. Most women my age have to read about life in a book. They have to read about what I've done in a book. I've gotten to experience it. And while I don't want to repeat a lot of that, I wouldn't take $1 million for total experience, because I'm a richer human being for having gone through it. I'm enriched. I've been blessed with alcoholism and the recovery from it. And it's a gift. And, you know, I stand before you and look out there at these throngs of women, recovering women. It is an awesome sight. And I think it's the most wonderful time in the world to be a woman, because we have come of age. We are on our own. And it's a wonderful time to be a woman. It's a wonderful time to be an alcoholic, because people are accepting us now. People really are having an understanding as we go around and educate and as we get sober and become good examples. It's a wonderful time to be an alcoholic, because people are accepting us more. And it's a wonderful time to be a woman alcoholic. And I like where I am today. I like who I am, and I like where I am, and I like the fact that I am a recovered alcoholic woman. I like that about me, and I wouldn't want to swap my experience for anybody else's. I think I have a wealth of experience to draw from. Well, my first addiction was not to alcohol, and my first addiction was to pills. And it happened one time when I quit smoking, one of many times that I tried to quit smoking. And I went all to pieces. And if you've ever quit smoking, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I got so nervous, and I couldn't eat, and I couldn't sleep. I lost 40 pounds in about that many days. Fortunately, I just had a baby and had a lot of excess weight to lose. And it was a miserable time. I couldn't think. I couldn't sit still. I was totally manic. And I went to the doctors, and they said, "Well, it's your nerves, and just take these pills, and you'll calm down." So first they gave me Nembutal. And I took Nembutal for about a month, hated the way it made me feel, went back, said, "I don't like this," so he gave me Valium. That went on for another month. I went back, gave me Librium. And then it was Senequan. And then it was Elavil and Trivil and Seconal and Cerax. And on and on and on. And I abused those pills, was addicted to those pills at any given time, depending on what I happened to be taking at the moment. And that was the beginning of my addiction. And giving up smoking is not the reason I'm an alcoholic and addict, but it just happens to have to do with the timing of when my problem started. I had been a school teacher, and I had married, and I had had 3 children in 3 years. And so it appears that alcohol and drugs were not the only things I was addicted to. And those 3 little children were just little babies when all of this began to happen. They were just little stair steps. And very quickly I began not to be able to take care of them. I was so wrapped up in myself, so into me, so worried about me, concentrating on me, I couldn't take care of the children. After about a year, I decided I hated the way the pills made me feel, and I was going to give them up. And so I stopped taking the pills and continued to do what I thought was social drinking. And within a matter of days, I was drinking alcoholically. I had just switched addictions. I'd been addicted to the pills, kept on drinking, and became an alcoholic overnight. Drank alcoholically, rather, overnight. And I never drank any other way from that time. I was daily drinking, never drank any other way but alcoholically from that time on. Could not function quickly, could not take care of my children, could not take care of my household chores. Fortunately, I had a full-time maid, so that enabled me to continue drinking more because she could take care of the responsibilities. And I also had parents who enabled me because they took care of my responsibilities on the weekend. And I was allowed to continue on my progressive road. It was a horrendous time. I began to withdraw. All of the outer shells peeled off, and I began to withdraw from the garden club, from the bridge club, from my children's swim practice and music lessons and dancing lessons, and just withdrew. Got my days and nights mixed up, would stay up all night drinking, sleep all day while the maid was there to take care of the children. And my disease progressed so rapidly that in a year and a half, I was hospitalized in a psychiatric unit. And I'm confident it was not diagnosed as alcoholism. As a matter of fact, there, they told me I was not an alcoholic. And I thought that was great. They said that I had marital problems and mental and emotional problems. And I said, right. And if we'll take care of those mental and emotional and marital problems especially, then I won't have the desire to drink too much. And so I bought a gallon on the way home from the hospital because they had said I was not an alcoholic. So I was off and running again. They referred me to a psychiatrist to see 3 times a week. And that psychiatrist put me on massive doses of Thorazine. And that psychiatrist said a fascinating thing to me. He said that Thorazine would help me to organize my thoughts. Well, my experience with Thorazine was that it stripped me of the ability to think, and we didn't have to worry about organizing any thoughts. But he also said something else to me that I still hear ringing in my ears sometimes, and it makes me so angry at him. He said that I was so emotionally ill and so mentally ill and so inadequate and so unable to cope that I would never be able to live a day of my life without Thorazine. I would like some rebuttal time with him today. I would like for him to follow me around for an hour of the day and see how I cope and see how much I do and how well I function. I'd really like that rebuttal time. But at the time, it was terrifying. Because on Thorazine and alcohol and whatever else I might have been taking that I don't even remember, I didn't exactly want to live, and I didn't exactly want to die. It was just a state of such despair that I just didn't know how to go on. And I thought, if this is the way I'm going to feel the rest of my life, I'm just not sure I can handle that. And yet there was something that kept me hanging on. I wasn't suicidal. Something kept me hanging on. But I hated the way that Thorazine made me feel. I would stand up and fall down. And I would call him and say, something's wrong. And he would say, you're not taking enough. Take one every hour instead of every 4 hours. And I would take one every hour, and I would stand up and fall down. And this went on for the better part of a year until finally I walked out of his office after about a year and said that I would not be back. But, of course, that was a terrifying thing because I thought he was my last hope. At the time, I thought the psychiatrist was the last place you can go, Martha. I thought, if the psychiatrist can't help you, where do you go? There is nowhere else to go from there. And it was a horrifying day when I left him because I felt hopeless. I felt totally hopeless. It was a terrible time, just one of total despair. And with that kind of feeling inside this dark night of my soul, I discovered that my telephone was tapped and that a private detective was following me. And I knew that was designed to get my children away from me. And it was terrifying, agonizing. Well, I didn't want that private detective to see me going in a liquor store. So I began to look around in the grocery stores. And there were things with alcohol. I found Micrin mouthwash. It had 18% alcohol in it. And it worked. I drank it, and I got drunk. And I went back, and I bought Scope mouthwash. And I drank it, and I got drunk. And I went back, and I bought Listerine. And I had the sweetest breath in town for a long time. And I began to look for everything that had alcohol. And I found vanilla flavoring. Oh, that's got 68% alcohol. And lemon extract, 84% alcohol. I mean, that's powerful stuff. And I drank it, and I got drunk, and my disease progressed. And the message to me in all that is that if my drug of choice is not available to me for whatever reason, even if it is in my mind that I don't want a private detective to see me drinking it, I will drink whatever is available. That is the message to me. And I want to remember that. Because if I ever take a drink again, I'm sure that's the road that that progression will take. Well, obviously, things had to get worse. I was denying that I was an alcoholic. I looked around. I said, I'm married to a wealthy man. Look at this lifestyle. I have this luxurious home and this all this acreage, and we have Cadillacs and Mercedes and many, many boats and all these material possessions, and I'm too good to be an alcoholic. I'm college educated. I've been a school teacher. I have three beautiful children. I'm too good to be an alcoholic. And all this time, I'm in my third story bedroom drinking my vanilla flavoring and my lemon extract, denying I'm an alcoholic. The insidious nature of this disease, the denial in the face of stark truth. Well, that could not continue. If you can say that what your drug of choice, if you say your drug of choice is what you drank the most of, then my drug of choice, the last 2 years I drank, was vanilla flavoring. And I think I ought to be more damaged than I am. My marriage ended as it had to. And if I ever thought that I was in trouble as a married alcoholic, I had absolutely no idea how much trouble I could get into as a single alcoholic. And my friends from Alabama are here for me to tell all the nitty-gritty about that year of my life as a single alcoholic because they've heard me say, but I'm not going to tell you that part from this podium. So they tell me last night that they've come all the way from Alabama to hear me tell the nitty-gritty of being a single female alcoholic on the scene. But girls, you know what that was like. You know what that was like. It was a horror story for the following year. Not knowing where I was, who I was with, total loss of self-respect, self-degradation, unable to take care of anything, unable to function, withdrawn in my bedroom with a bottle by my side of whatever the liquid was the day of the day, the pills on my nightstand, whatever the pill of the day was. And that's the way I lived, and terrified that somebody would find me. I couldn't take care of my children, who miraculously had been allowed to live with me. They were shuffled back and forth from time to time. They were the parents in the household. In fact, I teased them sometimes to tell them they did a good job of raising me, because I really turned out all right. But they were the parents in the household, and I was the child. And my little kids had responsibilities that no children ought to have. And, you know, that is the horror story of alcoholism to me, the effect that it has on the family. At least my senses were dulled. I felt pain, but I couldn't feel it like my children felt it cold sober, and my parents and my husband felt it cold sober. At least I was dulled to a lot of the pain, and at least I was blessed with blackouts so that I didn't always know what I had done or what I had felt. But my little children weren't so lucky. And one of my memories is of my little son standing on the stoop on the front porch, begging me at midnight not to go out and get another bottle. And I went anyway. And his little face with panic on it was still standing there on that porch when I returned with that bottle. And he had been left at midnight in full charge of the house and his two little sisters. And he was about 7 or 8 years old. And another time, in a desperate effort not to drink, when I drank on top of Anabuse, taking Anabuse, desperately trying not to drink, fell and cracked my head open on a wooden chair. And my son had the responsibility in the presence of mine to call an ambulance and a doctor, my parents, and my son was 8 years old. And my daughters had the responsibility of dragging Mom to a bed and mopping up the blood off of our white carpeting. And my daughters were 5 and 6 years old. And that's alcoholism. That's where it really is. With everybody scarred, everybody hurt, nobody that it touches escapes. I was hospitalized in 3 psychiatric hospitals altogether. Another time I was hospitalized at Parkwood, another time at Northside from an overdose of Thorazine and alcohol. And it was a horror story for my children. I don't know how they survived. And yet if you were to ask them today, they would tell you that there are many more benefits for them than scars. But that's the way my children were living, with me in and out of hospitals, shuffled back and forth from their father's house to my house, having to take care of me, having to cook for themselves. I couldn't get them to school all the time. I couldn't get them home. It was a miserable experience for them. Well, the last time I drank on top of Anabuse, my children were taken away from me. And I knew the ultimate degradation for a woman, that of being labeled an unfit mother. And I thought it was the end of the world. I thought I never wanted to live. I lay in bed for 5 days with the sheets pulled up over my head, and I did not want to live. But I did live, and I drank nonstop for the next 3 months. And let me tell you about the end of my drinking. When I was divorced and moved from this luxurious estate, I was looking for a rather modest condominium where we were to live. And I tried to find a condo that was close to the private school that my children attended, because I had to drive to that school 4 times a day. And it was a pain in the rear end to try to keep an addiction going and to have to drive to school 4 times a day. So I was trying to find a condo that would be really near the school. And I wound up buying a condo miles away from that school. Must be 10 miles. I don't even know. Never clocked it. But it is miles. I had no idea why I bought it, except that it had trees. And I was leaving all these 38 acres of land, and I was thinking, well, at least these trees right here outside my unit will be a little tiny yard that my kids can play in. That's why I thought I bought it. Well, I lay in that condo off and on drunk for the following year. And I began to hear construction outside my bedroom window. And I could look through the trees, and I could see the roof line of a building, and it looked like a school. It looked like a one-story schoolhouse. I thought, isn't this wonderful? I've moved out here in the middle of the boondocks. I'm having to drive to Holy Innocence 4 times a day, and they're building a school right here in my backyard. I mean, literally, just across the way. The kids could go right out the back door and walk to school. Well, that building turned out to be Peachford Hospital for the... And that's written on page 84 of your big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we were unable to do for ourselves. And I believe God said, this one's tough. This one is too sick. I have got to make it easy for her. So Peachford Hospital was built right in my backyard. And Mom would go to school there instead. And on the morning of February 25th, I was admitted at 7 a.m. in a long black evening dress that I had had on for 4 days. And a wig that was on sideways that I had had on for 4 years. And one thing you can be absolutely sure of, that what you see is always my hair. However bad it looks, it is always going to be my hair because I wore wigs for 4 years, and I will never do that again. I had a flashy silver belt hung low around my hips, not on my waist, on my hips. And do you know, they did not make fun of me. At least in front of me, they didn't make fun of me. But having been to a staff meeting or two since then, I know what they did. I did not go to Peachford Hospital to get sober. I went to Peachford Hospital because I was exhausted. I had been drinking nonstop for 3 months. I was exhausted, and I was hung in the middle. I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get sober. I was hung in the middle. I was too scared to go into withdrawal and too exhausted to go get another bottle. And that's why I went to Peachford Hospital, to get some medical attention for a few days to get me well enough to be able to control my drinking and get custody of my children back. And that was my motivation for getting there. And I left there 21 days later, and I wanted to stay sober whether I ever got my children back or not. And you ask me what happened? Love happened. Unconditional love happened. Those people put their arms around me, and they said, honey, we understand. Don't worry about anything. Just hang in there with us one day at a time. Just be here. Just trust us. We've been there. We understand, and we love you. And that's why I stayed. I'd like to tell you I stayed because I understood the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't even comprehend one day at a time. And I stayed because the love felt good. And I think that's so important for our recoveries, because we're starving for that love. And I'd like to tell you I stayed sober. But I didn't stay sober. I stayed sober 10 months, and then on New Year's Eve that year, I went out and I had one drink. Prior to that one drink, I had begun to feel good. I felt good physically. I felt good mentally. I had experienced some serenity and some peace of mind. And I was accomplishing a little job, and I felt good about that. I was beginning to be responsible. I had accepted the fact that my children were indeed gone from me and were not coming back, and I was dealing well with that. And they told me I couldn't get involved with anybody for a year. Did any of you ever hear that? Don't get emotionally involved for a year. But after about 8 or 9 months, I thought I was weller than everybody else, and I got involved. And so I got involved, and immediately my program began to slip. And he became more important to me than my program. Being with him was more important. And that relationship deteriorated, my program deteriorated, and on New Year's Eve, in anger at him, I got drunk at him. I'll show him, I'll get drunk. So that's what happened, and I took one drink, And nobody will ever have to tell me what one drink will do to you, because I know firsthand. I took one drink, and all of a sudden, I was filled with panic. I was filled with compulsion to continue. I was filled with fear. I was filled with the inability to cope, regardless of what was going on. I was filled with fear rather than serenity or any peace of mind. All of that was stripped away from me. All of it was gone, and one drink had done it. I didn't drink anything else for a couple of months, and I might as well have been drunk every day, because every good feeling I'd ever had was gone, and one drink had taken it away. I don't ever want to forget that, because I do know firsthand that it's the first drink that gets us drunk. And I was destined to drink more, destined to get drunk, and I did. Several more times, and wound up in Willing Way Hospital, and went through treatment there again, and by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not had a drink or a pill since May the 3rd, 1975. I'm really grateful for that. I'd like to tell you that I saw the light at Willing Way. It was agony. I didn't believe I'd ever get sober again. My attitude was, you had 10 months, you blew it, you know, you'll never make it, you are constitutionally incapable. And I came back to Atlanta, and Dr. John had recommended that I continue working, and I didn't want to face those people, but he recommended it, and I went back to work, and the thing that saved me was that I had to support myself. I no longer had a wealthy husband to take care of me. I no longer had parents to enable me. My children were gone. I was on my own. And the grease that I'd thrown at my dad in a drunken fit was on the wall. The hole that I'd burned in my carpeting where the cigarette was still there. The walls screamed at me in silence. I was alone to be responsible for myself. I didn't believe I'd ever make it. And the thing that saved me was I had to work. And I went to work every day, plowed through the day, went to an AA meeting, fell in bed emotionally exhausted, and got up and did it all over again. Every day, work, meeting, fall in bed, do it all over again the next day. And lo and behold, 8, 9, 10 months later, I am still sober. And I'm the most surprised of all. I had accidentally learned how to live one day at a time. Total accident. I understood that concept. Finally, after all those months, I understood what one day at a time, it means just putting one foot in front of the other and getting through the day without a drink. Finally, I understood that accidentally. Wonderful experience, though, and very powerful. And, you know, I'll share this with you. I didn't take chips. I don't share this all the time either. I didn't take chips. And you know why I didn't take chips? Because I didn't think I'd ever make it. And I didn't want to embarrass myself by going back and getting a white chip again. So I just never took chips from the beginning. And this year I picked up my 10th chip, my 10-year chip. It's the first chip I've ever had. You know, I decided after a while that, God, this one day at a time is really working. And the reality was that I loved the way I felt sober, finally. I really began to love the way I felt. And the sobriety became the reward. And then it was no longer important to me to take a chip. The one day at a time had worked so well for me, and I felt so good. And I loved being sober, and I wanted to be sober whether anybody noticed or not. And that was another powerful experience this program gave me. But this year, for some reason, there was something kind of special about 10, and I decided to take a 10-year. I was a sneaker at the Tri-City Group, Alcoholics Anonymous, near my office where I go a lot. I found everything. After I began to feel good, I found everything I was looking for in this program. I found a conscious contact with a higher power that I call God. I loved that feeling because in that Baptist church back in College Park, Georgia, I had tried so hard to feel God. I had gone to church every time the doors opened. Every time Billy Graham came through town, I rededicated my life to full-time Christian service. And I tried to feel God. And every time I left those meetings, I went away empty, thinking, there ought to be something else I ought to feel, something different from the way I feel. Where is the feeling? And I never understood it till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Never did. And I feel that conscious contact. I have direction. I feel it. I've shared some of those experiences with some of you one-on-one this weekend. Some of the most incredible spiritual experiences that I can believe possible that have happened to me in this program. And it's an awareness that a force that I call God is directing my life. And that not only is that direction there, I can trust it. I can trust that God's will for my life is better than my own, because I'm not doing anything in my life today that I had planned to do. Nothing was in my plan. My plan just about put me in a grave. But God's plan has been more exciting than anything I could ever imagine. And now in my sobriety, it is easier for me to believe that God's will is really better for me than my own. And I'm finding myself, the longer I go, taking control less and more willing to trust God and to really turn my will and my life over. Those efforts are easier now as I go on. Wonderful experiences. I've learned to love me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought I would like who I was, but I like who I am. I like what God, whatever God is, has done with me. I like it. It feels good to me. I never thought I'd say that. I am a single woman today. I love being single. I never thought I'd be able to say that. When I was divorced, however many years ago, I thought if I didn't get married again right away, it'd be the end of the world. I thought I'd hate it. I thought I'd be an outcast. I love being single. It is wonderful that God has given me the ability to like who and where I am. And I have found that in this recovery program. And it's the most wonderful feeling. I looked all my life for it. I was searching everywhere for what is right here in this room and in this program. It is the love and the fellowship and the principles and tools to live by. Wonderful. I have found everything I need right here. And I'm grateful. That's why it's a blessing. That's why alcoholism is a blessing. Because it's given me. It hasn't taken away. It has given me. And I needed some strong sobriety because I have been exposed to more trauma since I got sober than I ever thought I could experience when I was drinking. But the difference is, I don't have to drink today. It doesn't matter what happens to me, I don't have to drink and I don't have to take pills today. I know in the deepest part of my being that I've got what it takes to handle whatever comes my way. And that is such a comfort. I can't tell you. You know what that feels like. It's a comfort to know that God, the God within, can handle whatever happens, whatever comes my way. I could tell you about so many days in my sober life, because there have been many, many beautiful days and many wonderful experiences. But I had one experience that was the most profound and the most powerful in my life. And I would like to share that with you because it had so many messages for me. I accepted the fact that my children were gone. And I began to grow and become responsible for me. And I began to feel good and accept things as they were. And my life was going real, real well. And I find that that's where I have to be for God to let me move to another step in my recovery. I have to fully accept where I am at the moment before I can grow up to another step. Just like to accept my alcoholism was imperative before I could recover from it. To accept the fact that my children are not responsible for me, for my sobriety, or for my happiness was necessary for me to have a different relationship with my children. And once I learned that Toni Curry is responsible for her happiness and for her sobriety, and that that is contingent on my spiritual condition on a daily basis in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, God gave me a chance to have my children back. And it happened, and by that time I was growing and I felt good, and by that time, ironically, I was saying, oh, I'm not sure I can handle that. Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm not ready for that. You see, the messages came from my ex-mother-in-law. And when your ex-mother-in-law, who didn't speak to you the last 2 years you were married to her only son, says you need to do something about your children, it's scary as hell. And I said, oh, I don't think I'm ready. No, that may not be right. It may not be God's will. I'm doing so well. What if I were to fail? What if it weren't right? All of the what ifs, fighting God's will. The messages kept coming ever more, every day from other people. You need to do something about your children. You need to do something. And I kept saying no. For 5 months I fought it until God absolutely backed me into a wall. And I felt that I had no choice but to fight for custody. And I wasn't even sure why. I just knew that I was led. Because I had spent many months every day with my sponsors retching over that decision. And I had a wife and husband sponsor team, in addition to three other sponsors, because when I got out of treatment and they said, get a sponsor, I got five sponsors. And I needed every one of them. And they all have been valuable to me, and some of them still are. And they said, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to 190 meetings in 90 days, just like an addict. And I needed every one of those. This time, my sponsors had been on either side of me. I'd been down to their apartment every day trying to get them to help me with that decision, and they'd been so supportive. And we finally believed that that was what we needed to do, and I filed for custody. Immediately, I was terrified because I was fighting wealth, power, influence, prestige, all of the above. And I was a working, recovered alcoholic female, and I made about $3 an hour. And I did not have the option of not working. I had to support myself. It just didn't seem possible. It seemed futile. And there were times when I was so scared, and I would say, God, why have you done this? Why have you led me to this? It just seemed so futile. One afternoon, it was even more so. All the kids were over it visiting me, which by now they are rarely allowed to do. And we're all sitting on my bed, and they're talking and sharing. And Angie, my baby, said, Mom, you wouldn't believe what so-and-so said about you. They said you used to be passed out on the floor with no clothes on. I have never yet figured out what it was about alcoholism that made us all take our clothes off. I was at a meeting not long ago at St. Patrick's in Atlanta, and the subject of the meeting was, how is your life different now than it was when you were drinking? One lady said, well, my life's different in a lot of ways, but one way it's different is that I don't get drunk and take my clothes off and clean my house anymore. And Angie said, and they also said you tried to run Grandpa down with the car. And they said you hit Grandpa in the face and broke his glasses and cut his face all up. And I thought I probably did those things, although I had no recollection. But I lived in blackouts. Well, I started trying to explain it all away to Angie. And Angie went into hysterics. Angie started crying, thrashing around on the bed, really crying hysterically. And at that moment, I had such a hole in my stomach at the pain that child was in and that I was in. And I thought, God, why have you done this to me? Why have you done this to this family? Because this family does not need to endure another hour of pain. Why, God? And God gave me the most powerful answer. Angie stopped crying, and she said, Mom, I know you did all those things, but just don't tell the judge or we'll never get to live with you. And do you know, from that night, I had a kind of comfort that at least God's will was going to be done. My sponsor had always said, Tony, God's will is going to be done whether you like it or not. And if you want to be happy, you might as well rock along with God's will. And if you want to be unhappy, you can just bash your head into bloody little bits fighting it, because God's will is going to be done. And I felt a sense of comfort that God's will was going to be done and that it would be okay, from what Angie had shared with me that night. I share with you the most powerful day in my life, the most profound day, the most traumatic day, and the most wonderful day, all in one. I don't know why God continues to give me the very worst and the very best all together. But that was the most traumatic day I've ever lived through, and I'll share that part of it with you first. I got up on the witness stand. My sponsor was going to take the witness stand to testify for me, and I was going to testify. And when they put me on the stand, I was scared to death, shaking all over. And then, as I began to talk, the most incredible calm came over me. And I began to share with wonderful poise and calm, and I was collected. I volunteered information. I didn't hold back anything. I gave them more than they asked for, shared my whole story. I shared the sordid, gory part of my story, and I shared my spiritual journey in recovery. I shared it all with complete comfort. And later on, I would realize that there was not a thing in the world they could ask me that I would be fearful of talking about. Because by that time, I had accepted where I was with my alcoholism. I had done my fourth step and the fifth step, and I had done my eighth and ninth steps. I had made my amends the best I could, and I really did try to live every day by the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. And I was willing to share it all with them. And it was a wonderful freedom that I've never experienced quite so vividly as I did that day. A freedom, the willingness to tell the truth, which had been given me by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the willingness to be honest. And I didn't have to be afraid. I did not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door. And it was a freedom. The truth had set me free. Wonderful experience. And then my sponsor took the stand. And this was the trauma. They said, Mr. Johnson, can you promise us that this woman will be sober next week? And he said, no. I cannot promise you that anybody in this room will be sober next week. He said, we cannot predict the future. And within a few minutes, Jimmy Johnson was dead. He got down from that witness stand. And he felt so good about my testimony and about his testimony. And it was going so well. And he took his wife, Johnny, outside the courtroom door. And he said, honey, if we could have written a script, we could not have written a better script. God's will is being done. And that morning when we left his house, Jimmy had led us in prayer and had prayed for God's will. Not that I would get my children, but for God's will. He said, God's will is being done. He said, "You know what, Johnny? We have 3 new grandchildren today. Let's go get a cup of coffee and celebrate." And he was gone that minute. I have never felt so alone. I never felt so angry at God. I felt responsible for his death. And I learned the most wonderful thing about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had lost one sponsor, but I had hundreds of sponsors. Because everybody in Atlanta, Georgia, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous came and held our hands in that hour of tragedy. And the miracle that in that hour of the greatest tragedy in my life, it never occurred to me to take a drink or a pill. That's the power of the program. And the people in the program helped me to understand that I am not God and that I don't make those decisions. And I was reminded that Jimmy always said, "God's will is going to be done, whether you like it or not." And acceptance does not mean I have to like it. But I can appreciate it a little bit more today, because an autopsy showed that Jimmy Johnson had terminal cancer, and he would have died a very painful death in a few short months. And God allowed him to die with a smile on his face, helping another human being. And that was the way he lived. And it was fitting that he should die that way. That was the traumatic part of that time. And I'm sure you would guess that the glorious part of that time is that I was awarded full and permanent custody of my children. When everybody, including my lawyer, said it could not be done. But it was done because it was God's will that it be done. And we've had some wonderful relationships over the last years. Close relationships with my children. They are very special and very, very precious to me, each one in his own way. My oldest is the responsible child who took care of his mother and everybody else and is still responsible. He was the parent to his sisters when they were 5, 6, 7, and 8 years old, and they loved it because he took care of them. Now they're 18 and 19, and they think he's a pain in the rear end because he still tries to parent them, and they don't want him to parent them. But they're growing closer as they get older, and he's giving up a little bit, and they're getting closer to him, and it's wonderful to see their relationships developing even more closely as they get older. Wonderful experiences that we've had. It's just been a real powerful experience. As my sponsor said, there is a oneness between me and my children, and there is. There is a oneness there that we all feel. And Angie said to me the other day, we were going out for Catherine's 19th birthday party, and Angie said to me, "Mom, I was thinking about you the other day." She said, "It just seems like yesterday that you were a patient in a hospital. And look how far you've come. I'm so proud of you." And she is proud of me. And I'm proud of them. And they would tell you that they have many more benefits than scars from our journey in alcoholism and recovery. And I tried to send them to Alateen. They were all too young for Alateen, really, when I got sober. And they've never really been a part of it. But I'll tell you a cute story about Catherine. Catherine went to Alateen. I wanted so much for her to like it and be a part of it, even though she was 4 or 5 years too young. She came back that night, and I said, "Catherine, how was the meeting?" She said, "Well, Mom, all they did was sit around and talk about problems." And she said, "I just don't understand that. I don't want to sit around and talk about problems." She said, "I have never had a problem in my life, and I do not want to sit around and talk about problems." And this is a child whose mother's an addict, whose father was never there, who's been bounced around from governess to grandmother to grandmother to mother to girlfriend, maids, you name it. And she says, "I have never had a problem in my life, and I don't want to sit around and talk about problems." And that's still her attitude today. And that's one of the benefits of alcoholism, is that children have so many adjustments to make that adjustments and changes are just no big deal. And I tease my children a lot that adulthood is going to be anticlimactic. They're precious, and our family relationship is great. Every area of my life has improved because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was able to quit smoking finally with the one day at a time program. I was able to quit smoking. 7.5 years and 20 pounds ago, I quit smoking. Woo! And thank you for not smoking. I got up the courage and the confidence to go back to graduate school because of the confidence that I had developed in the program of AA. I was always so shy, painfully shy, but AA taught me to share and to be open and honest and comfortable with myself and believe in myself, and I had the courage to go back to graduate school. And so when I was 41 or 2 years old, I went back to the University of Georgia and graduated in clinical social work in 1981, and I wasn't even the oldest person over there. So it was a wonderful experience of something else that I can do, another way to branch out and grow through the program of AA. And my career has gone out of sight. Wildest imagination never dreamed where I would be today. I didn't plan any of it. It's like I heard Martha say last night, "What do I do in my profession? I don't really know. All I'm aware of is that I got sober, I went to AA meetings on a regular basis, I've tried to live according to the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis, and all of these things have been added unto me." All of these things. I am not aware of pursuing any of it. Just trying to stay sober and live right, and live my way into right thinking. When I was just out of Peachford Hospital, they hired me to work in detox. And my first job in this field was making up beds. And I had been a school teacher, and I was hired to make up beds and to haul trays down the hall to the detox wards. And I was proud of that job. I was so grateful to be able to do something, to function. And I was so proud of it, and I took a lot of pride in what I did and the way I did it, and I was conscientious, and they noticed that, and they promoted me, and they made me a counselor. Counselor in training at first. They trained me, and then I became a counselor, and then they promoted me to follow-up care coordinator, checking on patients after they left. And then, lo and behold, Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals came along and said, "You've got to have an aftercare program." Who was sitting in the logical place to write the aftercare program but the follow-up care coordinator? That's where I was. So I wrote and designed and developed the aftercare program for Peachford. And I like to say that I had the dubious distinction of being the only staff member ever at Peachford Hospital to go from DTs in detox to aftercare coordinator. And that program that I wrote became a national model. Who on earth would ever have dreamed it? And then I became a Joint Commission consultant, and they traveled me around the country to help hospitals set up aftercare programs. And I did that. And then it was one day after 5 years, time to leave Peachford, and I moved over to Ridgeview Institute, where some of my buddies worked back there. And I had another wonderful experience, wonderful education at Ridgeview Institute, and just enormous opportunities. Began working with companies there. And through my work with the companies, one day when I least expected it, loved my job at Ridgeview, was not looking for a job, did not want a job, God gave me an opportunity to have my own counseling center. Dumped it right in my lap. And that's what I have today. For the last 3.5 years, I have my own center. And I get to work with a lot of alcoholics and people who go into recovery. And that's a joy, because it's where my heart is. My heart is there. And I also work with a lot of other problems. The companies refer people to me, sometimes with other problems. And I just like to say that those people don't have the foggiest idea how much AA they get. And you and I know that God grant me the serenity works for every problem. It doesn't just work for drinking, and everybody can benefit from that. So they're lucky that I'm in AA and can share that with them. They wouldn't have it otherwise. They're lucky. My career is growing faster than I can keep up with it. You know, it's just snowballing, and I'm just running as fast as I can to keep up with it. It's wonderful. I've been elected president of 2 organizations that are not made up of recovered alcoholics, and they know my history, and they've elected me president. I'm respected in my community by people who are not alcoholics. That's why I say alcoholism is a gift. It's been an asset to me. I've never shared it with anybody, but what they didn't look up to me, I believe. And it was an asset, and they saw me as a better person because of it. And if all of that were not enough, gifts to be given in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Last year, Governor Joe Frank Harris appointed me to the Governor's Advisory Council on Mental Health. Now, it is incomprehensible to me that anybody with a history like the one that I just shared with you would be deemed appropriate to be an advisor to anybody on anything, much less to the governor of Georgia on issues of mental health. It's so overwhelming to me, I can hardly stand it. But you and I know that it's because of that history that I have value to Governor Harris. It's because of it, because he knows I'm richer. I'm a wealthy human being, and I love the way I feel in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. I wouldn't take anything for being a recovered alcoholic. I now know what it means to be a grateful recovered alcoholic. And let me close with my favorite thought for the day. On October 27th, which happens to be my surviving sponsor's birthday. And so it's special to me for that reason. And it says how I feel about being sober. I can help my fellow alcoholic. I am of some use in this world. I have a new lease on life. God has given me direction and meaning for my life. All that feeling of futility is gone. God has spared me all the hazards of my alcoholic life to bring me at last to a place of real usefulness in this world. He has let me live for this. It is my opportunity and my destiny. At last, I am worth something. But I was always worth something. It just took the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you to help me recognize that worth. And I am eternally grateful. Thank you, and happy day.